Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. As I said in the blurb, this topic of exploration feels like it's been a while in the making. I sort of felt like when I was working on it, if this was a recipe, it would be a slow cooker. I found myself wondering why that was the case. Like why, in my own thinking, because you know I'm responsible for so many of these of the talky bits in our setting, what is it about my thinking, my awareness, that has meant that we haven't examined this more directly? Because it seems so central to what we're here to do. Like talking about how we form systems of belief, we're always talking about systems of belief. We're always talking about examining them and taking them apart. But I don't think, in my recollection, I don't think we've ever talked about deliberately about their assembly. And when I started digging into it in more detail, I was reminded of some things that I knew but wasn't carrying front of mind, like so many of the things that we know as humans, that gave me some clues about why it's taken me this long to get to this. We'll get to those in due course. But I think there's some structural reasons why this topic hasn't been a topic in our setting to this point. So just to give us a little bit of the sort of lay of the land for this talky bit and you know, at least a couple of subsequent ones, what I'm planning to do is spend our time today giving us sort of an overall framework for what the basic building blocks are for belief systems. And then in subsequent talky bits, I'll dig a little bit deeper into a couple of those building blocks that I think are more obviously relevant to what we're on about in this context. So I'll just unpack them a little bit in our setting. And I'm going to try not to be too sort of pedantic or teachery in this first one, but we are talking about this topic today in terms of systems. And so if you can cut me a little bit of slack for describing things in terms of systems today, that'd be much appreciated. You call it, of course. All right, so short version first, and then we'll drill down into the pieces a little bit. I should also say before we get into this, there are, of course, lots of ways that we could talk about this idea. There's lots of different ways to conceive of and give language to systems of belief. And I think it's important to sort of name that and to consider it and to use those considerations to challenge the way that I'm going to present this. So short version, think for yourself. You know, this isn't something to swallow whole, but I think it is a fairly useful, graspable way of entering some reflection on this. So overview first. I'm going to give us these ideas in a sequence, but I think it's important to understand from the outset that these ideas, as we experience them as human beings, they don't tend to function in a linear manner. They're not sequential steps that we go through, but I'll lay them out like they functioned that way. Okay, so just so we can kind of keep that in mind. I'm going to suggest that we think of systems of belief as having three essential pieces. You just decide what you call them. The first piece, I'm just going to call them pieces, but they could be called metaphorically. It works to think of them as building blocks, to think of them as supporting pillars. There's lots of different metaphors we could use. But the first piece is the one that I'm going to call core assumption. And I'm going to give us some fancy names for some of these bits and some expanded definitions here shortly. But the second piece, so I'll just give you the overview first. So the first one is core assumptions. The second piece of belief systems is one we're going to call values, and we'll expand on that name a little bit. And the third piece is narratives. So let's expand on some of these with some definitions. So for our purposes, we're going to talk about core assumptions as meaning this: our foundational truths about reality. So if we're building a system of belief or we're examining one consciously, the first bit, kind of the foundational piece here, are the things that we regard or accept as absolute truths. Now, we're in trouble already based on language, just by the fact that I used the word absolute, right? So I want to both leave that in place, and I want to also alter it a little bit. We may be of the mind that there is no such thing as an absolute, immutable, unchangeable truth. That is a perspective we could choose. But we might not. We might believe there are things that are there, whether we, to use Philip K. Dick, the novelist's, my favorite definition for reality, the thing that's there whether you believe in it or not, we might believe that there are things like that, right? So there's a range there, but I want to use that strong language for them because I want us to appreciate how foundational these are. Our core assumptions are the beliefs that we have that tend to answer or attempt to answer our fundamental questions about existence. So questions like, what is the nature of the universe? Is there a higher power? If so, what is the nature of that power? That kind of caliber of questions. And there's another sort of important pocket of questions that live in this realm, and those are questions about how we acquire knowledge, how we are both as humans able to, and how we functionally come to know what we know. So at the level of core assumptions, that's the level where we're asking those kind of questions. And that, perhaps obviously and perhaps not, extends into questions about the nature of human beings as knowers. How is it that we can know things? And then how is it that we do the things that help us know things? I said I was going to give us some fancy terms for some of these, just in case you enjoy that sort of thing or you want to sound smart at a party. Sounding smart at a party, if you use a term where you don't know what it means, hazardous stuff. So give us some meanings to go with the terms. This piece of our systems of belief tends toward the philosophical, partly because it's the most abstract of the bunch. It's the most kind of distant from our behavior consciously, right? So we tend to be a little bit philosophical about this layer. And there are two fundamental, in Western thinking, at least there are two fundamental branches of philosophy that examine it. And those are ontology and epistemology. And we'll talk about those here in a moment. So some definitions. Ontology, as a branch of philosophy, its core question is, what is reality? So that's an ontological question. If you hear somebody talk about an ontological question, that's what they're talking about, a question about reality. So it's the study of being, existence, and what actually exists in the universe. I'm broad brushing here. So if you've studied philosophy and you feel like I left out a favorite bit of your definition, let's talk later. But that's sort of the nuts and bolts of that. And then epistemology asks, how do we know what we know? So a bit more methodological, right? So it's the study of knowledge. And the study of epistemology focuses on things like methods, validity, scope of how we can understand something. How do we find it trustworthy? So that's a validity question. And what are some of the actual things we do, some of the methods we use to learn things and to know them? Now, that can all seem a little bit dry and dusty until you consider that the way that we answer these sorts of questions actually underlies most of our behavior. This is what's going on underneath there. Lots of times this is what's out of view for us, but it's what we're standing on. So, for example, if we're looking out at the world at something that someone else is doing and we're asking ourselves, perhaps in a perplexed or troubled way, how could a human being even do that? How could someone behave like that? Why would they, and so on, those kind of questions. The way that that person, and also the way that we, answer these core questions is essential to knowing why they or we behave the way that we do. The way that we behave is pinned to this stuff. We just don't often think about how it's pinned to it. This also comes into play when we think about how we behave collectively as humans, how we make societies, how we assemble our behavior, if you will. So, for instance, if we think about ourselves primarily as humans, as individual knowers, and we approach the world that way, we're going to function differently in the world than if we think of ourselves as collective knowers and we approach the world that way. So we had a little experience, a lovely little experience of this. Kareen, you'll have the details of this better than I would, but with the person who is the property manager for the apartment building where Taya and her cousin and roommate Kennedy live. When they were moving in, this person had a number of applicants and they had the power to sort of decide who was in there. And they were super helpful. They wanted Taya. At that point, Kennedy wasn't in the picture, but they wanted Taya in that building because they liked the experience they had with Taya. And in particular, I think they liked the experience they had with Taya looking for a place to live together with Kareen, who was working with her on that and was supported by a parent who was obviously both competent and caring. And her take on it, and this is somebody from a South Asian culture, Singapore. So from a collectivist culture, broadly speaking, and she was able to quite clearly articulate, if I help them, I help me. Like when I help somebody else, I help everybody else, right? Which is a different way of thinking than this is about me for me and it's about you for you. We're going to live differently in the world based on what we believe about the nature of a human being at that point, right? So I'm treating it like a binary in this illustration, and of course, it's awful lot more messy than that. But those are ways to illustrate how important this stuff is. If I think of my well-being only as my concern and your well-being as your concern, I'm going to live differently than if I think about your well-being as our shared concern and vice versa. That's going to produce different behaviors. Sometimes this stuff is buried deep enough in our lived experience or deep enough in our psyches that we're not even aware of it. And it can feel, honestly, it can feel a little bit painful to start rooting around trying to surface some of it. It can be kind of an unpleasant experience. But it's important work to do, not least of all, if we intend to thoughtfully and deliberately examine what we believe. So we're going to really explore what we believe. This is a layer we need to not ignore, even though it's a difficult one to access sometimes. I had a fascinating conversation this past week with someone, not from this community, to be clear, but whose husband recently had a very severe accident that came within a whisker of severing his spinal cord. I saw the scans. It's astonishing how close it came. Happy ending in that regard. The damage was repairable, but the recovery was, as you might be able to imagine, long and painful. It involved a period of time when the injured person couldn't do much but sit and, as my friend put it, sit and listen to the birds and think. About 3 months of that. One result of that time was what this person, when they told me this story, called a change in perspective, which included for this person leaving a very lucrative job that was making them deeply unhappy for a lower paying one that they love. A change in perspective is a great way to describe what we're talking about here, potentially. Now, I'm not saying what I'm about to say is not necessarily true of the persons in the story I just shared. It's an illustration springing off from that. But for example, if you think about somebody who might have an experience like that, how might our behavior change if we had a life experience that shifted one of our core assumptions from something like, I'm young and I've got all the time in the world, to something like, life is short and fragile and I need to make the most of each moment? Time is limitless. Time is limited. Time is expansive. There's less runway left ahead of me than there is behind me. Like those are, that's foundational stuff, right? And it deeply informs the way that we believe. So digging around in these powerful core assumptions to consider them and to ask ourselves as pointedly and honestly as we can, what do I regard as absolute, is pretty important work when it comes to considering our systems of belief. All right, I promised myself I'd lay all three of these out today. We're still on number one, so I'm going to move on. We'll come back to these another day and we'll set them aside with some time for us to reflect on them and discuss them. We won't do that today, but we will do it. All right, so if the first piece of a system of beliefs is our core assumptions, the second piece is our values. And you can see I've added morals to that. I'll talk about that in a moment. The reason I added morals to it is because our definition of this piece of a system of belief is that our values are our moral compasses, and they're derived, they're taken from or drawn from the truths of our core assumptions. So they're related to, and they kind of build on that. Our values, we can think of them this way. Our values are the principles that dictate what we believe is, I find an interesting and accessible list of words. Our values are the principles that dictate what we believe is important, desirable, good, or bad on that continuum. I know it's not always that clear, is it? But those kinds of values here, they're basically like the practical application of our core assumptions, and they guide our judgments and they guide our behavior. Now, I already suggested that core assumptions underlie our behavior, so that could sound like it overlaps, and that's the case. It does. They do overlap. Because as I also said a moment ago, these pieces don't function in a linear fashion. They're always sort of swimming in and out of one another. It's quite dynamic. We're making it less so for the purposes of trying to picture a system, but this stuff's pretty integrated. I personally find it helpful to think of my values as being built on, but more readily accessible and easier to name and to articulate than my core assumptions are. Less distant and abstract. So this feels like it's moving closer and closer to my ability to consciously connect what I do to what I believe, how I behave to what I believe, right? It's becoming more proximate to me as we go along. My values guide my behavior, could say a shorter sentence, my values guide my behavior in more visible ways than my core assumptions do. Doesn't mean they're more powerful, but they're easier for me to see. So for example, I might hear myself saying something either out loud or in my thoughts, something like, that's not okay. Or in the vernacular, that's effed up, right? Or it seemed like the right thing to do. Those kind of things are kind of coming out of my mouth or going on in my head. And I might recognize in those decisions or statements my beliefs about what I think is right or wrong, what is desirable or undesirable, what is good or what is bad. My values is a little bit more abstract perhaps to articulate, but it's not more abstract in terms of how other people experience me. My values show up loud and clear when I do things like set goals or simply even decide what I'm going to do next in my day. And by the way, if I find myself thinking that I don't have any say about what to do next with my day, that might point to a really good reason to examine some of my core beliefs about time and my relationship to time. There's a whole world of interesting self-examination waiting in the wings on that one for most of us. Okay, so that's the second piece, right? Values and morals. So on to the third one, narratives. And again, I've added something to it. I've added myths to it. I've said this here before, but I think it bears repeating, especially for those of us who might have grown up in environments where myth means something like fanciful, unlikely, or just plain not true story. That's not the way I'm using the word. And anytime I use that word, I'm consciously using it to mean guiding story. All right, that's my favorite definition for myth. I think it captures a lot. That is much closer as a definition to what we also mean in this case by narratives, which is the overarching stories that provide meaning. So when we deal with myth and narrative, we're meaning making. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to find frameworks that will carry meaning. So I'm a big fan of meaning making as an accessible explanation for a lot of human behavior. And I also believe that stories are one of, if not the most powerful way that we have as humans of carrying meaning with us. They're not always tidy stories, right? They're not always stories that we could, you know, tell somebody between floors in an elevator, right? Like they don't always fit on the back of a business card. And they don't always have this nice beginning, middle, and end shape to them either. And different cultures certainly approach this very differently. Western culture stories do tend to be a little bit more likely to have beginning, middle, and end. But there are lots of cultures that believe differently about time and human behavior and things like eternity, if you will, foreverness, where the stories don't have that tidy shape. They start and they get some momentum and then they just kind of keep getting more and more and more open. Which is very disconcerting for Western thinkers sometimes, if we're informed by that. So, stories that provide meaning. It's really sort of essential to this. We don't always think of our guiding narratives as stories, because to many of us, story still means fable or fairy tale or something that we might relegate to the realm of childhood or something childish in a diminutive or diminishing sense of childish, which is also, I think, a common thinking error. For something to be germane to a child should not diminish it. But by way of an example, if we guide our decision-making, for example, by seeking out scientific information, or what we might call evidence or data, and we claim that our decisions are guided by this information, evidence-based decisions, then our mythology is science. Okay, so I just want to put those two right in the same basket. If that's how we're making decisions, if that's our story, that's our mythology. And so I want to demystify the word mythology here a little bit and make it really sort of pragmatic in that way. What I mean by that is if we're making our decisions on that basis, then the story that science is telling us about the world is our story. It's the thing that ties the bits together. It's our mythology. I just used the example of science, but there's sort of three big buckets that we tend to gather our myths into. And again, very broadly speaking, I'm going to call those science, which we've already talked about, religion, and culture. All right? So those could be thought of as frameworks that connect our core assumptions to things like history and purpose, to things like explaining where we come from, where we're going, right? Those kinds of ideas. Now, we can tell at a glance that those are big buckets, right? Science, religion, culture, they're generous frameworks. Science, at least good science, is always setting out to disprove itself. So that is a narrative that is structurally destined for change, right? If our story is science, and we want to treat the story science is telling us as absolute, then we need to be absolutely committed to a narrative that is committed to change. those dominoes hit one another in a meaningful way, right? That's often not what happens when people defend their decision by sharing that their mythology, they might not use this language, is science. No, I based this on science. Lots of times that's an argument that is presented as though the decision was not one you could argue against, was absolute, forgetting that the very narrative that it's standing on is committed to changing the outcomes and finding the next, right? So we just got to, when we become conscious of this stuff, we start to handle it differently, potentially, and I hope in healthier ways. Religion, so if we start with science and we apply that sort of thinking to it, religion, which this model separates from culture, which I can appreciate, I don't tend to personally choose that because I find it more helpful to think of religion as a category within culture, but religion is also wide-ranging, like good science is. There are many different sets of core assumptions that fall under religion. Religion is a category, all right? So it's important to remember that. We might think that my religion, your religion, our religion, however we think about this, whatever we believe, if it's religious, we might think that's not a category. It's the truth. But it's a religion, and that's a category of human belief structures, right? Which is why, of course, different sets of core assumptions, we can have a religious war. Culture, which, again, you've heard me say this before, but I'll repeat it. My favorite definition is the way things are actually done around here. Culture is varied and nuanced enough that we have the term, for example, like subculture. We're trying to find a way when we do that with language to talk about how there can be cultures within cultures. So again, there's lots of room for variance inside of that idea. It's a big bucket. And I think that's important. And still, even with all those qualifiers, I think the model that I'm trying to describe here identifies the main categories of science, religion, and culture as an accessible and a memorable one. And those values of accessibility and memorability make it potentially helpful, make it graspable. So it's a handle on something that's too big to get our arms around, right? It's a way of talking about these things and working with them a little bit. Okay, so I'm going to wrap this up in just a moment here, but I want to add very briefly a couple of subcategories to what we've already got. So a little review. So we've got core assumptions, foundational premises that we accept as absolute truths, values and morals, moral compass derived from the truths of our core assumptions, narratives and myths, the frameworks that connect our core assumptions to history and purpose, explaining where we came from and where we're going. Now, I'm not going to expand on these last two in as much detail, but I think they're worth mentioning, not least of all because they can help us expand our way of thinking about all of this a bit, help us maybe use our imaginations a little more freely when we try to tease out what our own core assumptions, values, and narratives might be, for instance. We can think of them as parts 4 and 5 if we want, if that's helpful. So the fourth one, then, of these pieces is rituals and practices. Rituals and practices, I would invite us to think of as tangible actions or habits or ceremonies that reinforce our beliefs, all right? So engaging in these practices physically and socially solidifies the abstract concepts that we have into daily realities. And just a quick word here about rituals, like what I did with myths. If you're like me, that word might strike you as something a bit kind of out there, a little bit formal, a little bit esoteric. I don't have any rituals. Witches have rituals, you know, whatever, right? It feels like it's kind of arcane or something. So we might hear that word. We might think of kind of arcane practices. We might think of ancient or long-held religious formalities. We might think of things like a Catholic mass as a ritual or a traditional wedding ceremony as a ritual. I guess if enough people do it, then getting married in Vegas by an Elvis impersonator is a ritual. Now, I think that's true as far as it goes, but rituals are also a lot more common than that. We all have them. We just don't always name them this, and that's fine too, right? I had a person recently share with me one of their time management practices, which is that they come into work at the beginning of each day and they make, they had other practices, but within that nest of practices, they come in the beginning of the day and they make a to-do today list, okay? That's what they call it. And then when everything on that list is checked off, they draw a diagonal line through the page and then they tear the page up and they throw it in the garbage every time. That's a ritual, okay? And as soon as we started talking about rituals, where they were like, I got one. And they knew it was a ritual, right? Just to kind of, then we had sort of shared language for it. That's a ritual that takes the concepts of time, time management, task completion, and to some degree, meaning making of those same notions, and it turns them into an action. It turns them into a physical practice. Done. Yes. Little party, right? Really important. Brushing our teeth before bedtime can be considered a ritual, especially if we can discern that for us it's connected to our beliefs about health or well-being, right? So the distinction between a habit and a ritual can be a little fuzzy here, but I'll leave that alone. Alrighty, one last one, and then we're going to wrap this up for now. So the last piece of systems of belief that I want to identify today is what I'm going to call social and institutional frameworks. And like many of these ideas, we might need a little help moving this from the abstract into the concrete. So think about social and institutional frameworks as things like shared communities, shared texts, authority figures. But what these things all do in systems of belief is they validate and propagate a belief system. That's their function inside of belief systems, okay? That's the way they connect to our system of belief. So we might experience this if we go to a conference where the keynote speaker is the author of a book that everyone in the audience has read and appreciates, for example. That's why they're there. They want to hear the person who wrote that book talk. So that might be a thing that we have. I've certainly had this experience in collective religious settings over the course of my career where everyone assumes that everyone else in the room believes the same religious beliefs that they do, which, by the way, is almost certainly never the case. But as humans, we generally prefer the middle of the herd, so the outliers usually kind of keep a low profile in those settings. You know, if you don't want to get lynched by a mob, like, that's not the moment. Anyway, shared texts. Let me just pick a couple of the biggest ideas here, maybe. If you've ever heard someone talk about the Bible, like there was only one version of it, you have been in the presence of a powerful institutional framework assumption. That is just not the case. Like, it's demonstrably not true. But if it's a shared assumption, it kind of can have that institutional half to it. If you ever heard somebody talk about family, like there was only one version of it, same thing. Although that's maybe more of a social structure than an institutional one. We could argue about that. Same thing goes for Shakespeare. Ernie texts or collection of texts that tends to dominate a category. Okay, so to revisit our definition of that particular piece, pay attention to the last part of the definition, which was these things are shared communities, texts, and authority figures that validate and propagate a belief system. That's their function inside of the frame of systems of belief. That's what they're there to do. So if we're examining our own systems of belief and we want to identify who or what some of these might be for ourselves, just try to recall who you reference to validate your own point of view. So-and-so says, I read it here. I listened to this podcast, and the podcast host said this. I have a mentor who, right? So just listen to our own language, and it'll point us to these things. This is the kind of pointers that can help us figure out which social and institutional frameworks are central to our systems of belief. Can also, obviously, perhaps, but let's just say it, can also point us to those same things that are coming under critique internally for us, or that are starting to lose their grip for us. We're like, I used to believe this. I used to find myself comfortable here in this framework, and now I don't. Why? And then just keep going with the whys until we hit the one that actually sort of has some life to it and isn't just a trope, you know? All right, that's potentially quite a lot to take in at one go, so I'm going to leave it there. Here's what we've considered as the building blocks or the essential pieces of a system of belief. Core assumptions, the foundational premises that we accept as absolute truths. Values and morals, our moral compasses derived from the truths of our core assumptions. Narratives and myths, the frameworks that connect our core assumptions to things like history and purpose, explaining where we've come from and where we're going. Rituals and practices, the tangible actions, habits, or ceremonies that reinforce our beliefs. And then social and institutional frameworks, things like shared communities, texts, or authority figures that validate and propagate our belief system. Those are the bits, or at least a fairly succinct way to think about the bits that we use to construct a system of belief. Depending what the bits are telling us, we could think categorically about the system that we're making. I'm going to present this as a binary, but again, of course, there's options. We could think about the system of belief that we have as a hegemony, as it's inside a boundary. And all the bits fit tidily inside of there, and they work together. They collaborate. They self-reinforce. Or we could think about it as something that doesn't behave that way at all, that's really more like that's really a little bit more like advanced physics. There's a lot of bits moving around, and they're interacting with one another, and they interact differently depending on the context. And some of them can be in more than one place at one time, and it can get really messy, right? So there's lots of different ways to kind of construe this for sure. But I'm going to leave it there. And my hope, as is often the case with these sorts of things, is that when we go home, when we're on our own, when we're with people that we love and trust, whatever our context is, but where we're poking around in our own system of beliefs, my hope is that these ideas might provide us with some helpful starting points for that particular exploration of what we believe and that when we do come back to this together, it's going to give us all something that we can talk about together and meaningfully explore in the context of a community setting, in the context of other people who also have systems of belief, or who are examining or deconstructing or reconstructing what they believe. Because that's what we're here to do. We're here to explore what we believe. So let's keep doing that. And we'll be doing what we said we were going to do. All right? Peace.